When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This 80s comedy classic is one remake that actually surpassed the original. The plot is simple. Two con men with differing styles of grifting make a bet to see who can outswindle a wealthy heiress on the glamorous French Riviera. From slapstick antics to razor-sharp wit, Steve Martin and Michael Caine deliver a masterclass in comedy as they pull off one hilarious scheme after another, trying to outsmart and outcon one another. So slick back your hair, dust up on your accents, and don't forget to put the corks on the forks as Bethany Wells, Chris Adams, Chad Shepard, and I discuss Dirty Rotten Scoundrels from 1988 on this episode of the 80s Flick Flashback Podcast.
There are many pros and cons to vacationing on the Riviera.
This is what I want.
These two pros are working a very unusual con.
Mother? No, this isn't your mother. Miss Trumbull and I are going to be married.
Really?
And we are going to live in Oklahoma.
Steve Martin, Michael Caine are dirty, rotten scoundrels.
Thank you.
Starts Wednesday, December.
I'm Tim Williams, the mastermind behind the mic at the 80s Flick Flashback Podcast. Joining me on each epic episode is a guest co-host who's as crazy about 80s flicks as they are about wearing parachute pants and solving Rubik's Cubes. We're diving into nostalgic treasures we saw at the local theater, rented on VHS tapes, or discovered on cable TV. From blockbusters that make you say,
I feel the need for speed.
To hidden gems that'll have you screaming,
they're here.
It's a blast to relive these old memories and share our thoughts on what made these movies so special. We reminisce about our first time watch experiences, share our favorite scenes, and even discover fascinating behind the scenes tales about the cast and crew along the way. Haven't hit that subscribe button yet? What are you waiting for?
Come on, do it.
On Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your favorite podcast platform. And hey, while you're at it, be a pal and drop us a written review along with a 5-star rating to tell us what you think about us.
The Sportos, the Motorheads, Geeks, Sluts, Bloods, Wastoids, Dweebies, they all adore him. They think he's a righteous dude.
Take a day off and come hang out with us on social media. Just search 80s Flick Flashback on Facebook, Instagram, and TikTok. And don't forget to bookmark 80sflickflashback.com for more gnarly content.
Get out of town. I didn't know you did anything creative.
Want to crank it all the way up to 11? Become a supporter on buymeacoffee.com for only $5 a month.
Do or do not. There is no try.
Click the link in our episode show notes, and while you're there, soak up the extra trivia and fun stuff that didn't make it into today's show. Thanks again for tuning in. Now, let's get right into today's episode.
Welcome to the party, pal.
Welcome in, everybody. So glad to have you on this episode of the 80s Flick Flashback Podcast. I know I say it every time, but I mean it this time. We've got a good one tonight. This is going to be a fun episode, not only because it's a great movie and one of my all-time favorites, but because of the rogues gallery of co-hosts we have tonight. Who are not dirty, rotten, or scoundrels, but they still decided to come on here anyway. So first up, you know her, you love her. She is the wife of Laramie Wells, but she also is her own person, and we appreciate that. It's Bethany Wells.
You know, fellas, last year I made about $3 million, but this podcast was the most fun I've ever had.
I love it. And then from Retro Life for You podcast, Mr. Chris Adams. How you doing, Chris?
Doing great. Couldn't wait to get to this. I watched the movie again earlier, refreshed my memory on it because it's been a while, and It's still as funny as ever. And I didn't do this before I left, but you'll excuse me. I have to go to the restroom.
I almost did that one.
Of course. Yeah.
But again, Thank you. Psych gag part of it.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. The pause and the facial expression. Right. Like, oh, so great. And then last but definitely not least, Mr. Chad Shepard.
Oklahoma.
Yeah. Oh my goodness. Yeah.
Shout out to my father-in-law. That's his favorite part of the movie.
That is. So I had a friend of mine that would just scream that all the time after he watches Oklahoma.
I do that whenever someone mentions Oklahoma, which thankfully is not very often. And sometimes I forget that that's the movie it came from until I was watching this. And I was like, oh yeah, it's Steve Martin. Yeah, Oklahoma.
All right, well, let's jump in and ask our question. So when did you guys see Dirty Rotten Scoundrels for the first time? I will start with Chad, since he was the last one to be introduced.
I saw this in my 20s, but I remember the gags. I remember the going to the bathroom joke when I was very young. My parents loved that. They loved the movie, and they they did that joke a lot for some reason. I don't know, but okay. I was in my 20s when I saw it. Yeah.
Yeah. That scene I think was heavy in the commercials, and we'll get into trailers because there was no real trailer for this, only the teaser trailer, but we'll get to that a little bit later. But I do remember a very abbreviated portion of that scene they used heavily on like the TV ads or when it was on cable. Like they showed that one a lot. So
oh, yeah, that's my big memory of the movie before I even saw it. So yeah, definitely.
So how did you see it the first time, Chris? Was this a theater watch or VHS?
It was not theater. It was probably VHS.
Yeah.
Yeah, I had a friend of mine who was really big into it. He said, have you seen Dirty Rotten Scoundrels? I'm like, no, I've not seen it, Jayla. Well, you're going to watch it this weekend. You've got to see this. This is hilarious. And I was a little iffy on it first because when I was younger, I wasn't really big into Steve Martin.
Okay.
But as he kind of grew on me over the years, you could say.
Oh, yeah.
The biggest thing I knew about Steve Martin when I was younger was the King Tut song he did from Saturday Night Live.
Saturday Night Live. Yeah. Classic. All right. Well, how about you, Bethany? When did you see it for the first time?
Well, so the movie came out the year I was born, but
of course,
my dad loved Steve Martin. And so I was kind of raised on Steve Martin. So I was like the opposite of Chris. He was like, I was a diehard fan. And so we had this movie on VHS. I was very young, too young to understand a lot of the jokes.
Yeah.
But I remembered loving it. I loved him peeing on himself. Hilarious. So good. And, you know, just all the other gags throughout it. Again, Steve Martin, A+ in my book.
Yeah, I think I saw this one in the theater, but it wasn't like when it first came out. I think I was in Maryland when this came out, so I was living on base. And they had that theater I've talked about in other episodes where they had the theater on base that would show like second run movies, kind of like a dollar theater. It was only like $2 or $3 to see it. They only had it for a weekend. And I remember going and seeing it and loving it. And I was kind of already a Steve Martin fan, probably from some of the Saturday Night Live stuff. My dad was a big Steve Martin fan. So I hadn't seen like The Jerk or some of his like R-rated, you know, comedies from the 80s. I hadn't seen any of those, but I had seen like Little Shop of Horrors that he was in. And there's probably like one or two other ones that I just remember his face and knowing him. So I know when it came on video and on cable, I watched it over and over and over and over again. I mean, I knew a lot of this movie pretty much by heart, even rewatching it. So how long has it been since you rewatched it for the podcast? I'll start with Bethany this time. We'll go the other way.
I was talking about this before we started recording, but when The Hustle came out, we watched that. Right. And then it was enough similar for me to go like, I think I want to go back and watch the original. Mm-hmm. And I looked and The Hustle came out in 2019. And so it's probably been about 5 years now.
Okay. What about you, Chris?
I was earlier today. I rewatched earlier. I always try to watch the day of or the day before.
Right, but before rewatching it, how long had it been since you watched it
before? Oh gosh, back when I was a teenager.
Okay, so it's been a long time.
Yeah, I was probably a freshman or a sophomore in high school.
Okay.
That was around, you know, after it had hit VHS. So it came out in 88, I think.
Yeah, 88. Yeah, Christmas of 88.
I was a freshman in 88, so probably 89 or 90 I watched it the first time.
Okay.
And then just here recently again. Oh, wow. I hadn't watched it a lot over the years though. Other Steve Martin films I've gotten into.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty easily, the Three Amigos and
Three Amigos. That's probably the one that I probably remembered him the most from before this.
Yeah, and Sergeant Bilko and things of that nature. But I hadn't watched it in quite a while. I couldn't believe after watching today, it's been so long since I've seen it. I laughed so hard.
All right, how about you, Chad? How long had it been since you rewatched it for the podcast?
It's about the same. I kind of watched it the one time, and I don't know why. Like I love Steve Martin. And it's a good movie. Like I watched it yesterday and I watched it today.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, why haven't I watched this movie more? This is such a good movie.
Yeah, this is like one of those me and my dad would watch. Like, this is one of our movies that we love to watch together because my dad was such a big Steve Martin fan. And, Michael Caine is great. And it's it's a PG movie. There's, not too many of those around anymore. And even though it had some adult themes, it's fairly clean. So leaving us like Bethany said, as a kid, there's a lot of stuff that went over my head, but there's enough in it that it would keep me entertained as a kid. And of course, my dad's laughing at it for other reasons than I am, but but we'll get into like favorite scenes, and probably the scenes that are my favorite are because those are the scenes I related to the most when I was younger. But I've seen it since I've watched it, as a kid, but it's probably been, I think the last time I watched it was actually with my dad. I think it was at their house, and it was either coming on cable or I think he had the VHS out and he still had a VCR. And I was like, I don't care if it's because it's a VHS, we're going to watch Dirty Rotten, because I hadn't seen it in a long time. And we rewatched it on VHS. And this was probably within the last 15 years. So Hannah had been born by that point. So it's probably like 10 or 12 years ago when we watched it on VHS. So watching it again this weekend, and I'd bought the Blu-ray a couple of months ago, and I was telling Bethany before we started recording, I was like, I've been wanting to watch it since I got it. I was like, no, I'm going to wait. And so right before the podcast. But now I'm like, I wish I would have just watched it like 5 or 6 times since then to enjoy it even more. But it's been fun. All right, well, let's jump into story origin and pre-production. I know some of you may have already jumped into some of this, and if you want to add anything, please feel free. I tried to keep it brief. There wasn't a whole lot there. So the movie was originally intended to feature Mick Jagger and David Bowie, who had previously collaborated on the Dancing in the Street video in 1985. Bethany's face lets me know that she did not know that fact before we started.
I'm just wanting to picture that now.
Yeah.
Which one was Michael Caine and which one was Steve Martin?
I'm assuming Bowie was going to be the Englishman, and then Mick Jagger would be more the, well, they're both British, so I guess that's kind of weird, but I could see Mick Jagger being more of the crass American or the crass character, and Bowie be, I don't know. They could really both, who knows?
Yeah.
Yeah. So the studio bosses were impressed with their work and approached Dale Lawner to submit ideas for a movie featuring the duo. Lawner suggested a remake of Bedtime Story after seeing it on television. So if you don't know what Bedtime Story is a movie that this movie is actually a remake of. So Bedtime Story, or also known as his first title, King of the Mountain, which I thought was a much better title than Bedtime Story. Not that either one of them are great, but
not that either one of them give you any idea about what the movie is about.
No, right. No. Yeah. So the 1964 movie, here's the synopsis. The crash, Freddie Benson, played by Marlon Brando. Yes, that Marlon Brando enjoys setting up elaborate ruses to seduce women. The suave Lawrence Jameson, played by David Niven, likes to pose as a prince to swindle the wealthy. When the two men meet, they perceive the other as a threat, and upon the arrival of vacationing soap heiress Janet Walker, played by Shirley Jones, the two sweet-talking scoundrels compete to trick her out of both her clothes and her fortune. So, 1964, and actually in the 64 version, it was more about betting her than the money. Like, they added the money portion, I think, more for this version. So, interesting enough. So, eventually, Bowie and Jagger dropped out because they wanted to do a movie with Martin Scorsese because they were looking for, quote-unquote, a more serious project. Though, I think Bowie later regretted it and said that when they actually saw the script, or like when they saw the movie, they were like, it was a much better script than they thought it was going to be. Interesting enough, Eddie Murphy's production company also asked Lana to rewrite the script if they could get the rights to the movie from Universal, because Eddie Murphy had seen Bedtime Story on the recommendation from his uncle. Go figure. So Lana tried to sell the film to Paramount Pictures with Eddie Murphy attached, but they declined. John Cleese was also approached for a role, but declined. Richard Dreyfuss was sent the script, but misunderstood his role and prepared for a different character. Steve Martin read his part instead and impressed the director, Frank Oz, who offered him the role. Michael Caine was eventually chosen for the other role. When Caine asked why they were remaking a commercial flop, the director, Oz, explained there was no point in remaking a successful movie. Boy, if they could bring that back today. Frank Oz then tempted Caine with the offer of a villa in the south of France for the 3-month period of the shoot, which was conveniently situated between the villas of two of his old friends, Sir Roger Moore, 007 himself, and composer Leslie Bricusse. Michael Caine paid homage to David Niven by sporting a thin mustache, slick back hair, and double-breasted blue blazer. He was a big fan of David Niven, so that was his way of homaging him from the original. So that's how this movie was made. But yes, Eddie Murphy had wanted to do it, and then it didn't pan out for him or Bowie and Jagger. I think that's probably best.
I'd be interested if we would be talking about it on a podcast if it had been Bowie and Jagger.
I don't think it would have been the same movie or even as successful. Maybe for other reasons. It might have made money just on their namesake, but not be as memorable as this one is.
I'll tell you what, my dad would not have had it on VHS.
I don't know if I would have watched it at that point either. I mean, I saw the Dancing in the Street video. It was not that good.
Right.
I mean, it was pretty much 3 or 4 minutes of them dancing around, making kissy faces and everything. And that's about all it was.
You mean being Mick Jagger and David Bowie?
Exactly, being themselves. So.
Have you seen the video of that video, but without the music?
No.
No.
It's even more kissy face than you actually think. Yeah.
Yeah, there's a behind the scenes featurette on the Blu-ray that I have where Michael Caine was talking about when he was approached about the movie. He was like, it's set in the French Riviera. I want to make sure I'm not going to be in like Istanbul and pretending to be the French Riviera. I was like, I want to make sure it's like a real location. But also, fun fact, which I didn't write this down later, the beach scene that they have where Steve Martin's character is trying to throw himself in the water, that whole funny scene. So they had to actually put sand on the beach because the beaches there were all stone. They didn't have sand on the beach. So they literally, and they said where there was sand for you to have a beach scene, it was too crowded and it's all topless beaches there. So they couldn't do, it was going to be a little problematic for them, I think. So.
No problem. they could have done that.
It wouldn't have been a PG movie, but it's hard to have that kind of a scene in a crowded, you know, beach. Like
it could be, real quick, and they say, "Oops," you know, it could still be PG or something. You know.
And now these messages.
Hey there, fellow 80s movie aficionados! Are you ready to embark on a nostalgia-filled journey to the greatest era of cinema? Then look no further than the Retro Life for You 80s Movie Podcast. Join us every week as we rewind the VHS tapes, dust off those Betamax classics, and dive headfirst into the neon-soaked, totally tubular world of the 1980s movies. From the Brat Pack to action heroes, we've got it all covered. Breakfast Club, Ghostbusters, E.T. and Indiana Jones, and more. It's like a trip in Doc Brown's time machine, but without the DeLorean. So whether you're a diehard 80s film buff or just curious about the cinematic gems of the past, Retro Life for You is your ticket to the ultimate movie time warp. Follow us on Instagram and Facebook at Retro Life for You, and we can be found anywhere you listen to your podcast, as well as on our website, www.retrolife4u.com.
Let's jump into casting. All right, so we talked a little bit about Steve Martin. The only other Steve Martin movie I think I've covered so far on the podcast is Three Amigos, so I'm sure some of this may be a repeat, but It's brief as well. But Martin first came to public notice as a writer for the Smothers Brothers Comedy Hour, for which he won a Primetime Emmy Award in 1969, and later as a frequent host on Saturday Night Live. He became one of the most popular U.S. stand-up comedians during the 1970s, performing his own brand of offbeat, absurdist comedy routines before sold-out theaters on national tours. He went on to star in film roles in such films as The Jerk in 79, Dead Men Don't Wear Plaid in 82, a good forgotten 80s flick right there, The Man with Two Brains in 83, All of Me in 84, Three Amigos in 86, Planes, Trains, and Automobiles in 87, L.A. Story in 91, Bowfinger in 99, and Looney Tunes Back in Action 2003.
Look, if you're going to mention, Looney Tunes, you might as well mention My Blue Heaven, which is one of my favorite Steve Martin movies.
Him and Rick Moranis, for sure. Yep.
So good.
A sequel to Goodfellas, right? Like, sort of?
I was thinking the exact same thing.
Maybe a prequel. Maybe.
Yeah, exactly.
That movie affected the way my dad pronounced the word vegetables for years. He still will say, it's a vegetable, this very southern man. Mm-hmm.
Now, would it be
a vegetable?
Would it be a prequel or a sequel? Because it wasn't he in hiding at that point? So it would be like a sequel, basically, because he's in hiding from what he's done.
Well, Goodfellas is set in the past.
I think Goodfellas is when that character was doing all his running with all the bad guys and everything. And then when he turned, I guess, against him to turn evidence on them, they put him into
witness protection.
He's in witness protection and don't know how to act. That's who Steve Martin's playing. It was a Ray Liotta's role from Goodfellas, I believe.
I have a confession to make. I've never seen Goodfellas.
Same.
Well, I have a confession for you.
Well, it's not the 80s.
I hadn't either till I did it just last year.
For your podcast.
Exactly, yes.
But Steve Martin is great. I forgot. Planes, Trains, and Automobiles I had seen before this came out. So that's probably where I was a big fan of Three Amigos and Planes, Trains, and Automobiles. And I did, fun fact, I did see Dead Men Don't Wear Plaid in the theater. My mom took me and my sister when I was way too young to see that movie. And I did not understand anything that was going on. And then when I watched it back as a teenager, it was hilarious because it's just a send up of old gangster detective noir movies where he's splicing himself into old movies like Humphrey Bogart and stuff. So it's actually pretty funny, but I had no idea what was going on in that movie when I saw it. And in 82, I would have been under 10 years old. So yeah, I was not amused, but anyway, moving on. Michael Caine.
Hey, we're all thinking it.
Yep.
Yeah. As Lawrence Jameson, often playing a Cockney, Caine made his breakthrough in the 1960s with starring roles in British films such as Zulu in 1964, The Ypres File in 1965, The Italian Job in 1969, and Battle of Britain in 1969 as well. During this time, he established a distinctive visual style wearing thick, horn-rimmed glasses combined with sharp suits and a laconic vocal delivery. He was recognized as a style icon of the 1960s. He solidified his stardom with roles in Get Carter in 71, The Last Valley in 71, The Man Who Would Be King in 75, The Eagle Has Landed in 76, and A Bridge Too Far in 77. He received two Academy Awards for Best Supporting Actor for his roles as Elliot in Woody Allen's comedy Hannah and Her Sisters in 86, and as Dr. Wilbur Larch in The Cider House Rules in 1999. His other Oscar-nominated films included Alfie in 66, Sleuth in 72, Educating Rita in 83, and The Quiet American in 2002. He's also known for his performance as Ebenezer Scrooge in The Muppet Christmas Carol in 92.
Christmas Carol movie.
And for his comedic roles, Miss Congeniality in 2000, Austin Powers in Goldmember 2002, and Secondhand Lions in 2003.
Makes me cry.
But yeah, he was funny as Austin Powers. My father.
Faja.
Yeah.
That's funny.
Berger?
That's what my daughter calls me all the time. She'll say, Faja, I have a question for you.
I think this was like one of Michael Caine's first comedy roles. If it might have been his first comedy role, I think. But he's a great straight man. I mean, you need that straight man and, the wild card is Steve Martin. So it was good to see. I think a good pairing for sure.
They had really good chemistry between the two of them. It was, and it's surprising. Like, if you didn't know this movie existed and you thought Steve Martin and Michael Caine together, it's kind of just like, I don't see the connection, but seeing them together, they work so well.
Yeah, I agree. All right, moving on the list, we got Glenn Headley as Janet Colgate, the soap princess or the soap queen. What is it?
I forgot. Queen.
Soap queen, yeah. She was cast. Yeah, she was cast in several smaller films, including Nadine in 87, Making Mr. Right in 87, and Paper House in 88, as well as Lonesome Dove for a television, which she received her first of two Emmy nominations for Best Supporting Actress. But this was her breakout film performance. This led to her being cast in the blockbuster comic strip movie Dick Tracy in 1990, in which she portrayed the girlfriend Tess Trueheart. She went on to appear in the films Mr. Holland's Opus in 1995 with Richard Dreyfuss, Mortal Thoughts in 91 with Demi Moore, 2 Days in the Valley in 96, What's the Worst That Could Happen in 2001, and Confessions of a Teenage Drama Queen in 2004. On television, she had a recurring part on ER and Monk and was in the short-lived sitcom Encore Encore with Nathan Lane. Glenn and Bill Paxton played the parents of Emma Watson's character in The Circle in 2017. The film was released in April 2017. Bill Paxton died in February of that year, about 2 months before the film's release, and Glenn died from complications from pulmonary embolism in June of that year, less than 2 months after. So I didn't realize that she had passed away until I was doing the research, and so I never really like talking about actors that pass away on the podcast, but sometimes it's just like, I feel like she needed a mention.
I didn't know she was either.
Yeah, she was she was great. She was a great actress.
Do you know the other Steve Martin film she was a part of?
It's not in my notes, so then no.
She was in Sergeant Bilko. She played Rita Robbins.
Yes. Now I did read that. I didn't have that down. So yes, she was in Sergeant Bilko. And in that one, he was trying to, I think there's a scene in that one where he's trying to convince her that he can't walk in Sergeant Bilko as well. So I don't know if that was an homage to this movie or just a happy coincidence, but
she was also the mom to Ben Wyatt on Parks and Recreation. So shout out Parks and Rec.
That's right. That's right. I'm a big Parks and Rec fan. So yes,
me too.
Ben Wyatt.
Yeah. I first remember her in Dick Tracy.
Yeah. That's probably the bigger role that she's probably known for more so than this one, but I definitely remember her in this. And I was a big fan of ER, so I'm sure I saw her on that as well. So those are the main characters. The other two only other two actors I'll mention, only because of either I recognized them immediately, which I'm sure you know who that is, and the other one just because I recognized her and I was like, I know she's been in other stuff, and she's been in a bunch of stuff. So the first character playing the butler of Arthur, we all know, is Ian McDiarmid, who gained prominence for portraying Emperor Palpatine or Darth Sidious in the Star Wars franchise, starting with Return of the Jedi in 1983. He was also in Gorky Park in 83, Sleepy Hollow in 99, and The Lost City of Z in 2016. So he's done more than just be Palpatine and the butler in this movie. But yeah.
I was so glad to see him.
Yeah. As soon as he popped up, I was like, Palpatine! Palpatine's in the movie!
He's going to be the big villain.
Right, right.
When Steve Martin handed him his stuff and said, hey, can you fold my clothes and stuff? I thought maybe he's going to lightning bolt him.
Right, right. But he is kind of says, like, you know, shut up. Like he insults Steve Martin all the time. So.
Well, when he tells him about his VCR, no, send me the model of your VCR and I'll send you a check. He's like, oh, shut up.
Yeah. Very good. Good to see him there. So the only other actress or person in the cast I'll mention is Dana Ivey as Mrs. Reed. Her first film appearance was in Joe Dante's 1985 science fiction fantasy film Explorers with Ethan Hawke and River Phoenix. Her first major screen appearance was in Steven Spielberg's adaptation of Alice Walker's The Color Purple later that same year. Among her other film credits are Postcards from the Edge, Home Alone 2, Lost in New York, which is probably where I recognize the most from because I just watched it this past Christmas, The Addams Family, Sleepless in Seattle, Addams Family Values, Legally Blonde 2, The Adventures of Huck Finn, Orange County, Rush Hour 3, The Leisure Seeker, The Importance of Being Earnest, and as Sandra Bullock's mother, Ms. Kelson, in 2 Weeks' Notice. In 2011, she also played the role of Grace Higginbotham in the critically acclaimed film, The Help.
Amazing. I love her so much.
Yeah.
Anytime she shows up, I'm just like, oh, we know who the bad guy is. Got it.
Yeah. But she doesn't play the bad guy in this one, but she does. No. She does typically play those roles.
In the color purple, she's pretty heinous.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. Yep.
But to be fair, half the characters in the color purple are pretty heinous.
Yeah. Not too many good guys in that one. Not too many good guys. All right. Well, let's jump into iconic scenes, favorite scenes. So iconic scene, when someone says Dirty Rotten Scoundrels, what's the first scene that pops in your head? Chad.
Yeah, please go
to the bathroom. I had a feeling that was what you're going to say. Chris, how about you? Same.
What scene pops in my head when they say it? The first visual I get is Steve Martin with the patch on his eye.
Yeah.
And he's holding the fork with a cork. That's not the funniest scene to me, but that's the one that first comes to mind when someone brings it up.
Yeah. What about you, Bethany?
Honestly, it's the big final scene where you learn the twist is that she was the jackal the whole time and has pulled the wool out from under them. And just, I was watching it and I didn't watch it with the girls, but I got to that scene and Ruby like walked into the room and I had to pause it. And I was like, okay, let me tell you everything that's led up to this moment and then let you watch this scene.
Right.
And even though she had not watched any of the movies, she watched it. And then as soon as she realized it, she went, oh, what? And it's so good. Mm-hmm. It really takes this like silly comedy and turns it on the edge. It really makes it extra clever in a way that at first glance you don't think it's going to be.
Mm-hmm. And true. I would think this is one of those like first movies you would call with a twist ending, quote unquote, you know, that wasn't the buzzword back then. For me, the iconic scene for me is, most of the Rupert scenes, like the cork and the fork and him running with the pots and pans.
Oh, glow-mo.
Yeah. So, and then, you know, the poster is like emblazoned in my mind, the two of them standing there with the champagne glasses and, you know, just, it's like the marketing, they didn't really have to do too much. It's like, you got Steve Martin, you got Michael Caine, a title, Dirty Rotten Scoundrels. You want to go see it. I mean, it was all right there. You didn't need a whole lot of plot to be pulled in. So, but what about favorite scenes? Bethany, I'll let you go first this time.
Honestly, so one of the scenes that I always find just hilarious is when Dr. Schuffhausen is trying to prove, or is trying to pretty much catch Freddy.
Yes.
The lie that he can't feel his legs.
Yes.
And he's like beating him senselessly.
Yes.
And Steve Martin does such a great job of like not showing anything. And then at the end, he's like, I'm going to help you. And, and he's just like got tears in his eyes. I die laughing every time. Mm-hmm. It's so funny. It's where Michael Caine gets to just be a touch silly. He's still got that facade of being the, you know,
the doctor
and then the, but he's also like beating this man's legs senseless with a fire poker, something no doctor would ever do. Even if you don't have any nerve feeling in it, you could still break bones.
Right.
He's still doing it.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. I had that one written down as one of my favorite scenes for sure.
Yeah.
I'd rewatch that scene before we recorded because I just wanted to, you know, get refreshed some of the scenes. And even rewatching it, I was still busting out laughing. So like you said, the facial expressions when he hits him that low, he runs at him and hits him.
It's and so like ridiculous.
Steve Martin like holds his temples and like doesn't open his mouth, and you're like, you know, he's in pain. And then he hits him like four times, like, if my name isn't Doctor,
who's Eisen? Schuffhausen.
Yeah, the third is like the last one that really got me. Yeah, that's perfect.
And honestly, like I mentioned this before, the musical, that is a music number. Is him beating him. And so it's really great.
Oh my goodness. All right, Chris, what about you? What are your favorite scenes?
One of my favorite scenes, I'm going to go with one difference since I've already talked about the can I go to the bathroom bit at the dinner table. When Michael Caine is introducing Steve Martin from the bedroom and he's misbehaving and he says, what do we do when we have company? And he immediately throws on this rubber glove and looks like he's putting some kind of lubricant on it. He's like, no, after that. Like, oh, well, we apologize.
Yeah.
Look like, what's he getting ready to do?
Mm-hmm.
No. It's like
We all know what he's getting ready to do.
Right.
So funny you bring up that scene, because I was watching something else before we started recording, and it was the editor of the movie talking about how sometimes it was very difficult to edit the movie because Steve Martin and Michael Caine ad-libbed a lot, or they created some of those scenes, the outrageous scenes, just to, you know, they kept adding things to the script. And so he's like, you know, you have them just being themselves and it's so funny, but then he had to cut away to like other people reacting to it instead of trying to find how much is too much and how much is not enough. He said something like Happy Accidents, who said in that scene, he said when Rupert hugs her and then he kind of takes her in the back behind the curtain or whatever, and then he runs out. He said that was actually a longer scene. Like the scene went where he in behind the curtain, he kind of does to her the same thing he was doing to Michael Caine on the bed, like trying to like roll over on or whatever. And so, but when he jumps back out, and he said, Frank Oz came in, he's like, the scene is too long, we need to cut something. He's like, you know what? Cut the rubber glove. And all the women in the editing bay said, no, keep the glove. Cut out the thing with him trying to do it to the girl, the lady.
Yeah.
And Frank Oz was like, okay, it doesn't matter to me, whichever one you guys think is best. And so he was like, it makes no sense. And like, it's very like offbeat for that scene. He said, but it was one of those happy accidents where that's the scene that all the women were like, no, keep that. Take out the other scene. He's like, whether they really like that scene or not, they just didn't want the scene of him trying to mount the woman behind the curtain.
I mean, it's just, you've already seen him do it to Michael Caine.
Yeah, yeah.
It's redundant. Yeah. It's funnier that he does it to his brother, Michael Caine, than it is that he does it to this poor woman who's just trying to marry a prince.
Right. All right, Chad, what about you? Favorite scenes?
I like the montage, the montage of him like, training him.
Yes.
And he tried to do the leg crossover. He like slid down the
the pole.
Yeah. That was hilarious.
Yeah. That was what I was going to mention, was the whole montage is really funny. And I like that he's when he's trying to put his hand in the pocket, like, you know, it keeps showing Michael Caine doing it so perfectly, like sliding that hand in the pocket, and then he misses the pocket, and then he
falls. Every time.
Yeah. The amount of goop or gel that he puts in his hands to slick his hair back just grossed me out. And I was like, you know what? In the 80s, that's probably how much I would have put in my hair, because I wanted my hair to be slicked back like that.
Yeah, I was watching with my wife today, and she's like, I remember that hair gel. She's like, yeah, that's a lot.
Yeah, like, it was way too much.
For what he had to do with his hair, like, you know, way too much.
Yeah. But for me, all of my favorite scenes are the Rupert scenes. And the other scenes that are great, but those are the ones, like, because as a kid, those are the ones that I related to, because it was just so goofy and offbeat.
Which is so slapstick.
The slapstick, the physical comedy. But going back and rewatching it, I mean, I love the scene on the train when you first meet Freddie and he's doing the con to the lady about getting, you know, it's like, I just want to see my grandma. You know, I'm going to get her operation. I'm saving up and I'll just have this water. And she's like, I can't do that. No. And she's like, no, please insist. Y'all have the steak and the he's got his order already planned out.
Two beers. Do you want a beer?
Three beers.
Okay.
Three beers.
Like, I just love that introduction of him and then their interaction. Like, the setup is great because Michael Caine can see that he's like, you know, not as good as, you know, thinking he's not as good of a con man as him. And I love it when there's a line, which is the same line used in the bedtime story, as I found out, where Steve Martin says something like, you know, don't you know what it feels like to like take 20 bucks from a random stranger? He's like, no, it's a little below my class or out of my class. And which is such a great line because he's not telling him who he is, but because you know who he is, it just makes that scene even better. And then to have him set him up with the lady at the stop, you know, thinking he's going to get rid of him. I love him trying to outwit each other as the story goes on. Like every time they think, like when he thought he had him, having the sailors throw him in the back of the truck, which was.
Yeah. There were six sailors in that van. No, right. There were seven.
I'm part of the Royal Navy, you know.
And then that just hilarious moment afterwards where he's in a hotel room and he's like, and it looks like he's actually had a good time. And he's like, could you hand me that to get the super glue?
Yeah, super glue solved it. Yeah, his hand is super glued to the wall, which is great. Yeah. And I, you know, it's funny because the two sailors, like the one guy that the one guy that talks more, he seemed familiar, but I couldn't find him. Like when I put up his IMDb, he wasn't somebody that I'd recognize. So, but yeah, that was a fun part. So, any other scenes we want to talk about before we jump into trivia? Maybe we'll think of some others as we're going. But I mean, there's a lot of great scenes. But like I said, there's a lot of physical comedy that you can't even describe because Steve Martin is so fantastic with the facial expressions and the timing. It's just great.
We don't give the whole movie away, right? But leave some imagination for the people who watch.
Oh, well, if you're listening to the podcast, you haven't watched the movie yet, you know better by now. And plus, Bethany's already spoiled the ending for them, so it doesn't matter.
I have spoiled the ending.
Thanks this movie is a lot. Thanks 30, a lot.
Had you not finished watching it yet, Chris?
I was going to send this podcast to people that I know who have not seen it, but now I can't do it.
No, you can't.
It's 35
you
have to watch the movie years old. First. So. That's on them. It's really easy to get.
Oh. All her fault. It's all her fault. Tim says you're not invited back anymore.
Did not say that.
Yeah. My wife came home while I was watching the ending and she sat down and I was trying to guess what the ending was. And she looked at me. She's like, have you not seen this movie? I was like, yes, I have. But I did not remember. The part about her being, you know, who she was. And
yeah,
I thought it was like everybody else. I thought it was Steve Martin who he was talking about. But
Part of the reason why I remember the ending is I was obsessed with the musical when it came out in 2006. And it's just such a great story. And that ending, it's so good. And then I was also telling y'all earlier, I'd watched The Hustle a few years ago. And it's fine. It's not terrible. It's just not as good. And it's fine. And
who was in The Hustle?
It's Anne Hathaway and Rebel Wilson.
Okay.
And see, I did not realize that Glenn Headley had passed before this movie came out or before that movie came out.
Mm-hmm.
And because there's like, I don't want to spoil that movie because it is only 5 years old. But there is an allusion to her character.
Okay.
And I remember the first time we watched it, Laramie and I going like, why is she just not in the movie? Why do they have her? Like, she's clearly not too busy to be in the movie. We haven't seen her in anything a long time. And we looked and Laramie's like, she's dead. I was like, oops.
Plot twist. Yeah.
Something that you briefly mentioned that we hadn't really talked about is the director of this movie.
I guess I did kind of skip over that part. So yeah, Frank Oz, of course, is
made a movie with no puppets.
Yes. Oh, yeah. That was my first trivia. This is the first movie directed by Frank Oz that does not feature puppets.
And unless it's the third... consider Steve Martin just like a human puppet.
A human puppet. That's pretty close, yeah. But it's the third of five collaborations with Steve Martin. The others were Bowfinger in 99, House Sitter in 92. Little Shop of Horrors in 86 and The Muppet Movie in 1979.
I have a special place in my heart for Little Shop. So,
yes.
But yeah, it's all over the floor. Sorry.
So, yeah, but Frank Oz was a great director. He hasn't really directed anything recently. He's still alive, right? I didn't do any research on Frank Oz. I feel bad now. You called me out on it.
Sorry.
Paused.
Pause. Let me pull up IMDb.
He's alive. We're good. Okay.
All right, good.
In 15 awesome. Or 17, I forget which one it was. I just did a whole deep dive on him, apparently, because I was trying to do research.
Okay.
He directed a documentary called Muppet Guys Talking. And it's him, Dave, the guy who did Gonzo, Dave, I forgot his last name, Jerry Nelson before he died, the guy who did Pappy Prawn, and the lady who does Prairie Dawn. Do like a little documentary of them talking about how it was, about how the Muppets is like the only living original Muppet performers.
Gotcha. I did not realize Frank Oz directed Death at a Funeral, the British one.
Yes.
That's amazing.
Yep. Was that the British one or was that the
British
remake?
One?
Okay. All right. Yes. Yeah, so let me do a quick little mini bio of Frank Oz, because he is worth mentioning, of course. As a teenager, he worked as an apprentice puppeteer at Children's Fairyland Amusement Park. He is one of the primary Puppeteers responsible for the development of Jim Henson's Sesame Street and The Muppet Show, as well as over 75 other Muppet productions. George Lucas originally contacted Henson to play the part of Yoda in Empire Strikes Back, but he recommended Oz for the part instead. He developed the character's trademark syntax, returning to voice and puppet the Jedi Master in episodes 6, Return of the Jedi, and Star Wars Episode 1, The Phantom Menace. He began a career of behind-the-camera puppet and live-action filmmaking by co-directing The Dark Crystal in 82 with Henson. He went on to direct The Muppets Take Manhattan in 84, Little Shop of Horrors in 86, Dirty Rotten Scoundrels in 88, What About Bob in 1991, The Indian in the Cupboard in 95, Bowfinger in 99, The Score in 2001, The Stepford Wives in 2004, and Death at a Funeral in 2007.
I didn't know he directed Indian in the Cupboard.
Yeah.
I loved that movie.
He also did In and Out with Kevin Klein.
Yeah, I'm sure there's more than what was listed there.
Yeah.
We've covered Little Shop of Horror. We've covered a couple of John Landis movies, and you know they like to pop up in each other's movies. So Frank Oz he's in Trading Places as a cop. He's in Blues Brothers as a cop, which are both directed by John Landis.
See what this stuff does to children?
Right. PCP. Angel Dust. The Muppet Show character Fozzie Bear is actually not named after Frank Oz, as it widely believed. Fozzie Bear is named after Muppet Show builder Foz Fazakis.
Mm-hmm. That name's made up.
What a name.
I think it's Frank Oz. IMDb is wrong.
that Frank Oz also does the thing that you just said that guy does. That's just his other job.
It's Frank Oz in a wig.
Yeah.
There you go. Waka, waka, waka.
And now, these messages.
Are you a fan of movies and TV shows inspired by comics? Ready for a podcast that dives deep into the thrilling world of adaptations? Well, look no further. Welcome to Moving Panels, the podcast where we discuss movies and TV shows based on, inspired by, and adapted from the world of comic books. This is your go-to podcast for all things comics on screen. I'm your host, Laramie Wells, and every Monday, we explore the dynamic universe where ink meets action. We break down the classics, reveal hidden gems, and uncover the creative process behind your favorite adaptations. Subscribe to Moving Panels now on your favorite podcast platform, and join us on this epic journey through the pages of comics and onto the big screen. Remember, new episodes drop every Monday. Don't miss out. Moving Panels, where every panel has a story. Every adaptation is a blockbuster. Subscribe today, and I'll see you on the other side of the page.
All right, moving on. More scenes and trivia. So according to the DVD commentary, when Freddie is in jail trying to remember Lawrence's name, the entire scene, which is another favorite scene, was improvised by Steve Martin. Director Frank Oz was crouched out of camera range and tapped Anton Rogers on the foot to interrupt Martin when Oz felt that they had gone as far as he could with improv, which I think was great. That is a great scene where he's like trying to remember his name. It's so funny.
James Jetterson.
Yeah.
Lawrence
Jesterson.
Right. According to Michael Caine's autobiography, the tall, straight, black-haired girl dancing next to him in the disco scene is his real-life daughter, Natasha.
Aw.
This was interesting. In a test screening, the scene where Freddie gets up from the wheelchair for Janet didn't get many laughs, to the surprise of Frank Oz and the editors, Stephen A. Rotter and William S. Scharf. Lawner then had an idea. He suggested laying in some inspirational music, something hugely dramatic like Thus Spake Zarathustra or Handel's Messiah, Hallelujah Chorus, and they tried it, played it, and it got a good solid laugh. So I will say that is the most outrageous scene.
It's so dumb.
Yeah, and it's like, it's kind of there that you're kind of like, is she really that?
Is she that naive?
Yeah, that naive. Like, that's a better word. Was she really that naive?
You're not gonna let me down, are you?
Yeah. No, I'm not gonna let you down.
Go
yeah.
further.
Yeah. No, by the bed.
Yeah. And then so. She did. That was so sad.
What I love though is that I think was the moment where she was like, "Okay, I'm done."
Yeah. Yeah. She's like, I've taken as far as I can take. Yeah. But yeah, going back to what we talked about earlier about like not remembering not knowing about the twist ending at the end. I'm kind of like Bethany because the ending I remember, like that's one of the reasons why I love the movie so much, was that there was like this big shocking reveal that it was her the whole time conning them. going back and watching it now, it's been a couple of years. Like, I'm trying to watch it, trying to pick apart those parts where you're like, oh, it should be given away at this point. But I love the scene where she comes to Michael Caine crying and like, he stole all of my stuff. And I don't know, like, and it's like, she's doing the con, like the con is right there. You see it. And he's like, no, I'm going to cover the $50,000. And here's a little bit more. And then she's on the plane. She's like, I can't take your money. Helping is all that I need. And of course, in the bag is Steve Martin's clothes.
Well, she doesn't say she couldn't take the money when she gave it back to him. She goes, I can't take this. It doesn't belong to me.
And oh, then yeah.
She right. So she wasn't lying.
She didn't lie.
Right. Which is why she was the jackal, which I love that, you know, it's kind of mentioned at the beginning and they don't really like reiterate it too much in along the movie. I think it comes up, I think Steve Martin mentions it towards the end, but I do like that's kind of dropped earlier. Like they're looking for the jackal and they automatically assume it's another con man, not a con woman, which I think was really smart as well. That being like the twist that it was her that was conning them the whole time.
Today they would call it a con person.
Sure.
Con human. What I love so much about this is it, like, I don't care how much Michael Caine makes himself, like how much Lawrence tries to put off this air of superiority of like, oh, well, I only steal from corrupt women.
Right,
but you still like lie and definitely steal a lot of money.
Yes, from
anyone. Right. And then, you know, Freddie, Steve Martin's character, he doesn't care. He will steal. He will steal $10 just as quickly as he will steal $10,000. He does not care.
Right.
He has no scruples. They are both genuinely dirty, rotten scoundrels. And it's it's because they're so charming that you're kind of along for the ride.
Mm-hmm.
But that's what makes it so delicious when they're the ones that get conned.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's like, ha-ha, you think that because you're these suave, better than everybody else gentlemen, that you can snatch money from women you deem undeserving.
Right. Which is why I love Steve Martin's reaction at the end. He's like, the no good. Like, he's like saying all these things. Like, how could she so deceitful? Like, dude, that's you. You're like, you're describing yourself. And it's like, it's so well done.
Like I said, it's delicious. It's just,
yes. That's a great word. Great
but then Michael Caine's character is looking at it. He's loving it. He's
As soon as he realizes it, he's like, Yeah.
That was good.
All right. Glad you guys brought that up before we move forward. So this was cool. I found this out. So Lawner, the script writer, said that the end of the script, it turned out. So at the end of his script, the original script, it turned out that Lawrence Jameson knew all along that Janet was the jackal. He'd fallen in love with her. You think he's fallen in love with her because she's so guileless, so honest, so decent. And then she takes him and you feel bad for him. But in the end, you find out he did fall in love with her, not because of her guilelessness, but because she was such a good con artist. I think the director and editor saw that it could work either way, so they changed it a little bit. Maybe it's better, but it's an editing change. It's not that much different, actually. So that's kind of cool because, you know, you think he'd be upset, but he's like, no, it's great. Like, he loved it that she took advantage of them. So it's really a cool twist because you would think that, oh, she's going to end up with Steve Martin because they seem to be the pair that kind of fall in love. And really, it was like, nope, she's really more for Michael Caine because they're both just as dastardly. And he loves that about her, that she's dastardly.
I like the ending that they went with. I think it's just I love that it comes out that she is better than both of them put together. Mm-hmm. And then she goes and tells that group of tourists where she's like introducing all of them. Oh, and then she introduces Steve Martin. She goes, unfortunately, he's mute.
He's a mute. Yeah.
Gorgeous.
And
Michael Caine was Australian.
Yeah.
So good.
And he thought about it and automatically went in that accent.
The accent was great. And he did good with the accents, which I thought was pretty good too. And I think he said he made the suggestion about he wanted to do the Russian accent. Like, that wasn't in the script for the doctor to be Russian. Like, he was like, I want to do a Russian accent. And Frank Oz is like, you can't do a Russian accent. He's like, well, let me try. It'll make it even more funny. Yeah.
I'll prove it.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm Michael Caine. I can do all the accents.
Right.
My cocaine.
He's not like Sean Connery that will always sound Scottish no matter what.
I'm Sean Connery.
I'm a Spaniard.
Right.
Right.
I'm also a Russian submarine captain.
This is how Russian captains talk. No, you're Scottish.
Yeah, they have to explain his characters away. It was just like he was raised in Scotland, but yes, he's from here. We promise.
Right.
I can't do accents at all. Save my life if I try. I sound like the guy that works at 7-Eleven every time. It doesn't matter if it's an English accent or a French accent or Australian or whatever. I sound like the guy from the Simpsons who has the 7-Eleven store. I mean, I'm not trying to make it sound like that. You know,
right,
not,
right. But I mean, it's just how it comes out.
If it comes out to it, it all sounds the same. It doesn't change.
All right, so I mentioned the trailer. So if you go online and you look for the trailer of this movie, there's only one theatrical trailer, and it was actually a teaser trailer that they shot separately for the it was too early for them to create a, you know, clips of what they had filmed. So they decided, and it was actually a concept that Steve Martin came up with, and so they took an entire day shooting the teaser trailer. The trailer shows Benson and Jameson walking along the boardwalk, politely moving out of the way of other people, etc., with a voice saying something like, "There are numerous distinguished gentlemen in the world, refined, cultured gentlemen, nice men, but nice men finish last." As the last few lines are spoken, Benson pushes an old lady into the water, and Jameson shoves a kid's face into his cotton candy. And that was a teaser trailer. It was like 30 seconds long. And they said that, I read something where like different trailer companies had cut like three different movie trailers to like release, and Frank Oz didn't like any of them. So he said, "No, we'll just do the teaser trailer. That's enough." And it worked. All right, well, let's jump into box office and critical reception. Dirty Rotten Scoundrels opened wide in American theaters on December 16th, 1988, coming in at number 5 at the box office that weekend. It could not overcome Twins in its second week at number 1 and Rain Man making its debut at number 2. But it still did well. It made a lot of money. Rotten Tomatoes has it at 89% on the tomato meter and an 84 audience score. IMDb has it 7.4 out of 10 with viewers and a 68 on Metacritic. That doggone Metacritic is always wrong. So where does it land for you guys? 80s, 90s, 70s. I'll start with Chad.
It's a high 80s.
Okay. Yep.
And it's not like I've seen, like, I got other favorite Steve Martin movies and Frank Oz movies, but this is pretty high up there.
What about you, Chris?
I guess it depends on how the number scores go here as far as what grades are what, like A, B, C's, and D's or whatever. But
yeah,
it's like a low 90s for me, which would still be a B when I was in school, but a high B. High B, because there's a lot of movies out there I liked that I thought was funnier that I would definitely rank above it. And it's probably partly because I wasn't, you know, brought up on Steve Martin as much and watched a lot of the stuff. But I do like certain comedy situations he's in. He makes some things just so funny, and the rest of them, like Bowfinger, I didn't really care for Bowfinger too much.
Yeah, that one wasn't one of my favorites.
But this one and The Three Amigos and Bilko and those they just cracked me up. So I would definitely give him in, like, I'd say in the low 90s, which was kind of like a high B for me.
What about you, Bethany?
I'm going to give it like an 87. Okay. I feel like it's a high B because it's funny. It's clever. It's very clever.
Yes.
I think there's things about it that are just kind of, with today's lens, you're just kind of like, ugh. But for the most part, it still holds up really well. And it's very funny. So I'm going to give it an 87.
Yeah, I'm kind of, I think 89 from Tomato Meter is pretty accurate for me. Kind of the same reasons you guys are saying, like, there's other movies that are funnier. I mean, different kind of funny. I mean, it hits a lot of nostalgia notes for me, and it's one that I can definitely rewatch again. I wouldn't say it's my favorite Steve Martin movie. It's definitely in my top five, maybe my top three Steve Martin movies, but it's definitely one that I love and I enjoy and will enjoy watching again. And we talked about before we started recording that I think it holds up pretty well. Like I said, there's some problematic, you know, parts in the movie, of course, but overall it holds for an 80s movie, it holds up pretty well. Like it's still situational. It's still works. So
I will say as weird as it sounds, considering the fact that The Hustle came out 5 years ago and this came out 35 years ago, The Hustle's a bit more problematic than Dirty Rotten Scoundrels is.
I can see that. You were talking about a lot of the fat jokes that for Rebel Wilson.
That's pretty much all the punchlines are, because her, you know, with Steve Martin's character, he's trying to get stuff for his grandma. For her, like, her big con is she has this picture of this woman, this very thin, you know, Western beauty standards form of attractive. And she cons kind of jerk dudes into, like, thinking they're going to meet her. And then she shows up. And when they're obviously disappointed by it, she says, well, obviously that's not who I was going to be. I was just seeing if you would really love her despite her, you know, birth defect. And they said, well, what's her birth defect? And she goes, she's an A cup, like a double A cup. And so she cons them into giving them money for breast implants.
Oh, wow.
And yeah. And that's her whole con is this sister that she catfishes people with and then cons these, you know, D-bags into giving her money. Like, they're not great people either.
Right.
But, like, the whole joke is that they are disgusted by her because she is fat. And they are also disgusted by this fake person because she has a flat chest. It's just, it's gross.
Yeah. I guess that's why I never finished it.
Yeah.
All three times. I would thank you guys so much for wrapping this one up for joining us for this episode. This week's 80s flick flashback feedback. I'm going to share one of the reviews we've gotten on Apple Podcasts. This one comes from Ridiculous Patron US1. I think that's how it's spelled or how it's said because it's all one word. But anyway, they gave us 5 stars with a title of fantastic. And here's what they had to say about the podcast. The breakdowns are superb. The nostalgia definitely took me back. Really enjoyed how they go to the level of detail to mention there's a man in a naval uniform in the background that's actually on the projection Clark watches in the attic. You know what movie that was?
Hey.
That was Christmas Vacation with Bethany. Yes. Yep. Great perspectives from actors and the hosts have excellent chemistry. It's a must add. So thank you so much, Ridiculous Patron US1, for that awesome review. Really appreciate you taking the time to share that.
Yeah,
all right, folks.
That was my episode. I'm
that was your episode. Yeah. I planned that just right, didn't I?
Yeah.
Well, that's a wrap on this episode of the 80s Flick Flashback Podcast. If you enjoy the show as much as Ridiculous does, then show us some love by dropping a stellar written review and slapping a shiny 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts. Don't forget to hit that follow or subscribe button and spread the word to your fellow 80s Flick lovers. Do you have burning questions or want to shoot the breeze? Hit us up on Facebook, Instagram, or TikTok. And if you're feeling extra gnarly, consider supporting the show over at buymeacoffee.com for as little as $5 a month. And hey, why not deck yourself out in some rad 80s Flick Flashback gear? Check out our online store, 80sflickflashback.com and tpublic.com for all the nostalgic swag your heart desires. Thank you guys so much for tuning in. Thanks for my guest co-host. I'm Tim Williams for the 80s Flick Flashback. I've got culture coming out of my ass.
You're still here? It's over. Go home. Go.